So how do we know a good idea is really a good idea for First Nations children and families? Or that that good idea actually works in the diverse and distinct First Nations communities all over this country? Let's dig a little deeper and chat with experts in the field of child well-being about what the evidence says, what are some of the myths, and what works when it comes to supporting First Nations children, young people, and their families. You're listening to Season 2 of Spirit Bear's Ask an Expert podcast. So hello, everyone, and welcome back to Spirit Bear's podcast, where we talk to experts about questions that you want to know more about. And today's topic is money. Now, that's an important thing as we're thinking about how to deliver services for First Nations children, young people, and their families across this country. You can have a great vision, but given the challenges, we all will need some money to make those visions a reality. And especially in the areas of child and family services and Jordan's principle and more. And today, we're so honored to have us joined by Dr. Helena Gaspard, who's the Director of Governance and Institutions at the something known as IFSD for short, but the long name is the Institute for Fiscal Studies and Democracy out of the University of Ottawa. Helena has many roles. She's a researcher, an advisor, a teacher, a convener, and she really has worked a lot with First Nations and First Nations Child and Family Service agencies to define a funding approach long-term that sets a minimum standard to hold Canada accountable so that our kids aren't discriminated against by future Canadian governments in ways that harm them, unnecessarily separate them from their families. And all of that flows from that Canadian Human Rights Tribunal case that you've been hearing about for now 16 years. So please join me in welcoming Helena. Thank you for joining us, Helena.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Cindy.
Thank you. So you've been teaching me a lot about money. And, you know, most people who are thinking about developing a project at the community level, they think about how much money they need. But that's only one of the things that you should be thinking about, right? The funding level on its own is not enough. Can you tell us about what are the key things that you should be thinking about in terms of money to make sure it's making a difference for kids?
That's really well said, Cindy. As you know, when we're doing our work, the last question we ask is how much money is needed. We really spend most of our time trying to understand where people are starting from. Where are First Nations starting from? Where is an agency starting from? And then what do the people and the children and the families in particular and the communities around them or that they serve, what do they need? And so once we've figured out those pieces of the puzzle, then we start to understand how the First Nation or the agency might want to do their job to serve children and families. And then from there, we start to think about the different programs and services and maybe tools like a building or a culture camp that might be needed to deliver on that mandate. And then from there, we start to ask how much things cost. And then from there, we start to estimate the dollar amounts that might be required. There was something really important that you said too at the front end. When we think about money, right, money needs to do different things for us. Money definitely needs to make sure we can hire people and buy tools and buildings and cars and whatever else we might need. But it's also important that money is tied to something more than just a transaction when we're talking about child and family services. We really want to think about money as a long-term tool. And how money can be used not only to deliver the services, but to help make sure that children and families have what they need, because the amount of money is actually tied to their environment or tied to the way their environment changes.
Yeah, and this is really important to think about all the elements you're talking about. So if I'm in a nation and we haven't had the opportunity to deliver any child and family services so far, we're going to have to do some building blocks in order to build up our vision of what that community needs. Like, what is a healthy child and family in our community? Then where are we starting from right now? And then how do we put in place all the things that we are going to need to respond to our community and achieve that vision that we're talking about? One of the things that often happens, though, is you sit down with the government, be it a provincial or federal government, and they're going to offer you just a flat amount of money. And they're going to say, but don't worry, we're going to adjust it by inflation and population. Is that a good idea? Is that a good deal for kids if it's just adjusted by inflation or population, or is more needed?
We want to think before we talk about the adjustments. You're asking a really good question. Before we even talk about the adjustments, we want to make sure that the base amount is actually sufficient. We're often reminded that you can grow any program by population plus inflation, but if that base amount is insufficient, it really doesn't matter how you grow them because it'll never be the right amount. It might never be enough. So one of the most important things First Nations and agencies can do at the front end is make sure they have a good understanding of their needs and also to consider what's happening around them. We've been really fortunate to have been invited into a number of First Nations and to work with agencies in different places all across the country. And we've learned a lot about the different successes and also to the different challenges that they face. And those challenges look different in different places. And if you're in a First Nation or working with a First Nation that doesn't have year-round road access, what you need is different. Your costs are completely different. We go to grocery stores oftentimes when we're working in different places to try to see what it's like living in that environment. And when you're in a more northern community, life is expensive, and that regular inflation rate or a national inflation rate might not make sense for you because your baseline costs are so different. So getting that baseline right and making sure that needs are captured in a way that's connected to the differences in the realities of First Nations is a really important step. And then from there, assuming that that base is sufficient and connected to those different realities, then growing that base by different factors is important. Population and inflation are helpful ones, but inflation in particular is a smoothing factor. We should never be depending on inflation to actually correct for insufficient funding. If funding is insufficient at the starting point, it will continue to be insufficient, irrespective of the inflation rate that's applied. That's a really important message. Inflation is designed as a retrospective measure, right, to look back in time and to help adjust for some of the price changes that happened in the prior fiscal year. So we can't depend on inflation or an inflation rate, rather, to help ensure sufficiency of funding. One of the things that we've been learning about, too, is maybe thinking differently about inflation rates, and we're trying that out in our work. There's something called the Consumer Price Index, and that's a national or general inflation rate that comes from price data across Canada. That inflation rate changes every year. It's not fixed because the economic realities change every year. And so we find that that inflation rate, because it changes, can be helpful. Because when there are situations like the one that we're in right now, when we're seeing much higher than average inflation rates across the country, that consumer price index, the CPI, adjusts to reflect that. If we had a fixed inflation rate for our programs and services, which of course, you know, government might like because it helps with their planning, that might not necessarily reflect reality. So a few important considerations there. Always make sure that your baseline is sufficient because insufficiency or inadequate funding at the front end is not going to change or will not become sufficient because of adjustments for population and inflation. The second thing is consider the different factors that are being applied. You know, think about which inflation rate's being applied. Is the CPI good for you if you're in a northern community? Or are there maybe northern inflation rates that are being tried out and developed now? Might those be a better reflection of your reality? And then what are the other components that you might want to consider to help ensure your children and families get what they need? That means, you know, considering things like geography. You know, it also means considering things like poverty rates or the nature of maybe income-based poverty in the community as an important indicator of challenges that might need to be addressed by a service provider. So lots of things to consider on that front, but always make sure you get sufficiency at the front end.
Yeah, and that sufficiency, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but it really is about taking into account what are the needs and realities of your nation? What is the vision that you want to achieve for your children and families? And then what are those environmental factors that you're talking about? Am I up in a northern community? Has my nation been particularly hard hit by the multi-generational impacts of residential schools and other factors that impact on my nation? That's the type of thing that you need to consider in what we call the base amount. Is that right?
Absolutely, Cindy. So there are a number of things that could be considered. You know, when you talk about vision and, as you know, what maybe I would call mandate or, you know, purpose or the problem you're trying to solve, those are important considerations to frame out. You know, when we think about child and family services in particular, something that we've learned over the years is how interconnected all of these pieces are. We talk about child and family services, but we're really talking about housing challenges, and we're really talking about access to water and education and health and social services, right? We're talking about all of those things when we're talking about CFS. And so sometimes when you're thinking about how to best serve children and families, it becomes easy to start to think really broadly about all of the opportunities and some of the challenges that the community might be confronting. But CFS on its own can't solve everything. So when we're thinking about CFS and you're thinking about your vision, think about what wellness means, what well-being means for your community when it comes to child and family services. And that vision might be broad, and that's great. But then when you start to think about your mandate and the functions and the services and the activities that you're going to provide, that's when you want to start to think about, you know, what that might mean in practice. It would be wonderful to be able to deliver every last program, every last service that a community might need. But sometimes that's not always possible for a number of different reasons. And so being practical and strategic about how you might think about those programs and services can help get to exactly what you're saying, a point where you're considering what you need to deliver on those programs, services, and activities, and also to starting to capture them with consideration of everything that's happening around you, the effects of residential schools and intergenerational trauma, you know, where you are geographically, also to what capital might exist, all of those important things that impact that delivery of services for children and families can be helpful pieces to consider as you're building out your approach.
When you're starting out and you're thinking, well, you know, I can see the needs of my nation. We have overcrowded housing, a lot of trauma from residential schools. Unfortunately, that's leading to a lot of addictions. Those are all kinds of things I can see. But if you're like me, sometimes it can be challenging to think, well, how do you translate that into a budget? How do I have some confidence that this is going to be done in a way that actually will meet the needs of my community, not only today, but over time? And you're talking about the base amount as being important. That means making sure that I have all those funding pieces that are required today, and then looking at the adjustments that might be needed over time so that as my community circumstances and needs change over time and the broader environmental things like inflation, that I'm able to keep up with those needs as things progress. And this is really, really important. But if I don't have those resources, then what are the types of supports that IFSD can provide to help me get my vision of what I see around my nation's reality into funding approaches that I could understand and feel really comfortable with about moving forward?
I can definitely appreciate why looking at a blank page would be challenging and maybe disconcerting when you're trying to understand the cost of something. So at IFSD, we've been so fortunate that for the last several years, we've been working with agencies and First Nations that have shared their own information with us, their own information about what it costs to deliver programs and services, what it's like to deliver prevention, what you need, whether it's money, people, tools. They've helped us lay all of that out. And so the most important thing is you're not alone in this. There are lots of others, lots of First Nations, lots of First Nations Child and Family Services agencies that have been doing this work and that have collectively shared their information, and we've worked with them to put it together. And so there are what we would call proxies out there, right? Other examples of service delivery costs that First Nations or that other service providers can use if they're just starting out. or helpful rules or principles, funding principles, as we would call them, that might help to guide the building of a budget. So we often talk about a baseline budget. There are different ways of doing that, of building out or estimating what that baseline might be based on the types of services that you want to offer. Prevention, protection, maybe others. And, you know, and there are ways of looking at other First Nations or organizations that do similar work to help you estimate what it might look like in yours. And then from that baseline, there are different factors that you can add to help ensure that your budget is sufficient for the environment that you're in. Working with agencies in particular, there were a few that IFSD identified in the funding approach that was built bottom-up with contributors and collaborators from all over Canada. So from the baseline budget, there were important top-ups or additions for things like information technology or IT. That's everything from hardware and software. And the industry standard for that for not-for-profit organizations is about 5 to 6% of the baseline budget. So that's a handy principle. You know, there are other considerations about levels of income-based poverty to make sure that you have a supplement in your budget that you can draw on or that recognizes the fact that sometimes people might need help with rent or they might need a little support with accessing food or accessing other basic needs. And so things like that, like poverty prevention services is another great example, geography. And then also thinking too about things like information and data. Have you been thinking about the resources necessary to collect your own information, to analyze your own information, to generate evidence, right? That's your best offensive strategy. And it's one of the best ways to support your planning and your advocacy. And importantly, really importantly, you know, share with your First Nation what's working, what's not working, so that you can adjust your programs and services accordingly. And of course, there's capital and emergency and management and all kinds of other things. But, you know, a few things to keep in mind for sure. And definitely lots of information available that people can draw on. That's all public, thanks to the efforts of, you know, agencies and First Nations across the country.
So we kind of got three basic building blocks of funding. One is we got this baseline, which is about making sure that I can meet the needs of my community members and drive towards the vision of a healthy child and family within the environment I live in, whether I have overcrowded housing, whether I'm in a northern nation. Then we have these adjustment factors over time, things like inflation, or as you would call it, a smoothing factor. And then on top of that, we have these things called top-ups. They're not discretionary. They're needed in order to operate. But those are things like, well, I can't solve the entire housing crisis, but there's parts of this where I know that families who maybe are in a really severe housing situation, and if that was fixed, their kids didn't have to go into care. So I could provide some funding with that. And the information technology, well, I'm going to need computers in order to operate. So I get that. So we've got baseline, adjustments, and top-ups. Is that right?
Exactly. You've got your baseline budget that captures the basic programs and services, the basic elements of your mandate that you have to deliver on. And then you have those top-up factors that help you connect to your environment so that your funding is reflective of your reality, because realities change, right? Poverty rates could increase, decrease, right? All of those things are important. Population can increase, decrease. And then there's that third set, Cindy, as you said, things like inflation and those growth factors that come from demographic changes. And then, of course, inflation adjustments too.
And there's so many great examples of people out there who are doing this work. I can just speak from personal experience. Every time that I'm scared and I know nothing, I go out there and there's always somebody else who's willing to lend a helping hand. And so it's so good that this work has been done on child and family. And actually, in many ways, in Child and Family Services, we probably have the most detailed reports on fiscal requirements than many other areas because of the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal and all the work that was led up to that and all the work that you're doing now. Now, in the communities, they will have heard of kind of two projects. One is called Phase 3. And the other one is called First Nations Without Agencies. Can you just explain a little bit about what these are?
Absolutely. So the Phase 3 project, or what we call Phase 3, is an opportunity to test out all of these ideas about funding and how you measure what matters in practice. And we're really excited to be working with a mix of agencies, of First Nations Child and Family Services agencies and First Nations exercising jurisdiction. So we have a group of 20 in total, and we're working with them to look at what this funding approach looks like based on their reality. They're testing out indicators for measurement to see what works, to see what it's like in practice, to actually track changes for children and families over time. And so that phase three project is really designed to help refine what change could look like in a reformed child and family services system by considering everything from the starting point to the funding approach to the measurement approach, all the way through to considerations for transition based on different starting points. So that phase three project is all about recognizing the different points of departure and what change might look like, what reform could look like for them and their own environments. And so we're really grateful to our collaborators there who are continuing to help us learn so much and share so much with others in the same working for children and families. And then for the First Nations, not affiliated to an FNCFS agency, that work is continuing. And that work is all about understanding a baseline. You know, Cindy, you mentioned the importance of information at the CHRT. And we found that with First Nations not affiliated to a child and family services agency, there's really a big information gap. They look so different. They all have such different starting points. Some are looking to design and deliver services. Others are already delivering services. And then there's everything else in between. And so working with that group of First Nations, we're trying to unpack and better understand what they might want to consider when they're building out their own approaches. What are some of those really good guiding principles, questions, cost considerations when it comes to designing and delivering the child and family services that your First Nation wants and needs?
Yeah, it's an exciting time right now, right? Where we can really reimagine how to meet the needs of children and families, not only in child welfare, but hopefully more broadly. This work that's being done is really about collecting the wisdom that's out there across the country and developing a minimum baseline that we, at least at the Caring Society, are hoping will ensure, or as much as possible, provide a basis for holding the Canadian government accountable for non-discrimination going forward. Because in the past, the way that the government funded dictated what services could or could not be offered to children. And as the tribunal found, the funding was linked to the unnecessary removals of kids, not because agencies were just going and taking kids when they didn't need support. It was because those prevention services weren't available to those nation members that were available to everyone else, and they were experiencing higher levels of trauma. So this work is really, really important, is tying your funding so that it informs the needs of your community members and reflects the practice realities that you have. So I'm so grateful to all of you at IFSD and all the First Nations and First Nations agencies who are participating in this conversation as we continue this work. When you think about the kind of three things that people need to know about money, what would you say?
Three things, always three things when it comes to this work. One is the importance of funding, and making sure that funding is not only sufficient, but tied to a set of principles that connect to your different realities. Those principles like geography or something like poverty, and definitely population. So the importance of making sure funding is sufficient, tied to your realities through really good principles. The second is that consideration of structure. Structure, from our perspective, is crucial. Because structure helps to guide the rules, the terms, the conditions. It helps to inform how money can be used. And one of the things we've learned throughout this work is the importance of making sure funding flows on a regular timeline and that funding can be used in a flexible fashion to meet the needs of children and families. So the importance of that structure to make sure that resources on the ground can be applied to solve problems when they arise and to solve problems in the best interests of children and families in a culturally informed approach. The third consideration is accountability. And this for us goes back and connects to that really important, or those two really important rulings from the CHRT. One, to ensure that discrimination ends, and the second, to ensure that discrimination does not reoccur. You need funding structure and accountability to make sure that those two rulings are upheld. When it comes to accountability in particular, we're talking about information as an offensive strategy. So that First Nations, Child and Family Services agencies are collecting or owning or using their own information, not only to track changes so that they know what works for their children and families, but also so that they can improve their planning and also improve their advocacy. And that way, that information base that's theirs, that's actually connected to their realities, can also help to serve as an early warning signal so that no one ever again can say that there isn't a problem, or so that, you know, kids don't have to spend another almost 20 years at the tribunal to start to see some of these changes happening. So that importance of accountability is about information and using information to help monitor and manage progress and changes for children and families and community. So funding, structure, accountability, those are the three main messages from this work.
Yeah, and you know, with accountability, often you think about it as in terms of enforcement. If there was backslipping by your funder, could you enforce the funding agreement to make sure that it would keep in pace with the needs of your children and families? Or if your needs became greater than what you expected due to some kind of thing like a natural disaster, or sadly, with the affirmation of the children in unmarked graves, if more trauma happened to your community and you didn't see that coming in a predictable way, how could you adapt to that? So enforcement of funding responsibilities and this accountability structure you're talking about is so important. Are there any myths out there about the work that's going on that you would like to kind of clarify?
There are a few pieces that I think would be, you know, helpful to highlight. One is that change can happen quickly. There's such wonderful commitment and enthusiasm about, you know, taking care of children and families in different ways. And there are so many different ways that it can be done. But one of the helpful things to keep in mind is think about where you're starting from and think about where you want to go and what you need to get there. And change isn't as easy as just flicking a light switch, right? You need people, you need resources, you need different systems and processes to help make that change and sustain it and help it grow over the long term. So just to consider that transition and change, while exciting and really motivating, can take time. And you mentioned earlier, Cindy, there are lots of great models and examples and leaders out there that have done this for a number of years. Talk to them, seek them out, find others that can connect you with them, because there's a lot to consider about those different developmental stages as you're working through something that can be as complex as child and family services. So thinking about transition and the time for transition, that's an important consideration that we've been, you know, thinking about increasingly on our end. The other is about measurement. And I think you said it really well. Measurement is about accountability, but holding different parties to account, right? Making sure that children and families are getting what they need in different ways, and because those needs might change over time. But just because you're measuring something, it doesn't mean you are solely accountable for that result. And I think when we're talking about child and family services and the different environmental factors that influence the design and delivery of those services, like housing and water, we think it's so important that a child and family service provider track or be aware of housing needs in a community, or track and be aware of potable water access in a community. But it doesn't mean that that provider, whether it's the First Nation or whether it's an agency, is alone, right, responsible for ensuring adequate housing or ensuring there's potable water. But what that information does do is to help give meaning or context to what they might be confronting, say an increased demand for services or a particular type of challenge that the community is facing. So just keeping in mind that information is powerful, and information, when you're collecting it and using it, can be a very helpful offensive strategy. And so not to be afraid of capturing and collecting that information and using that information to help paint a picture of what's happening in your environment with children and families.
Yeah, and it helps us know if what we're doing is working. I mean, sometimes you think that something's going to work and you give it a shot and it turns out not to work, or sometimes it has other benefits that maybe you didn't anticipate. And that's all good to know as you're trying to work forward to meet the needs of your community. We haven't talked about Jordan's principle. We're going to have you back to talk about that Jordan's principle work. But on the child and family services side, what can people expect to hear in the next, say, several months that they should be watching for?
On the child and family services side, we're hoping for lots of information sharing in the next several months. things like capital needs, right? We want to share more about what our collaborators are saying about the different tools and assets they need to start to shift their approach from one that might be a little bit more focused on protection to one that's heavily focused on prevention and cultural supports and services, or culturally informed supports and services. We'll also be sharing more on some of the funding models and budget considerations. What do those funding principles look like? How do they play out in practice? Where have we seen some changes or refinements based on what we're hearing from collaborators? And then also, too, some more thinking on transition and starting to put those pieces together of what, you know, you might want to consider if you're thinking about changing a mandate or starting to design and deliver your own services. So some more on capital, some more on funding, some more on transition, and then certainly to some more on the general expenditures or of the federal government and some of those, you know, changing contextual portraits of the information that will be available from things like the census, as imperfect as it is, just to help ground some of this work in current realities.
Okay, Helena, so where can I find more information about these different projects that you have underway?
So IFSD has a special part of its website for all of this work in CFS. So ifsd.ca/FNCFS. And you can find everything we talked about there. In addition, we release a monthly update to all of our stakeholders. And if you're interested in receiving that monthly update about this work, you can email info@ifsd.ca and we'll make sure you get all set up.
That's excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Helena. You know, you've given us a lot of money for thought and ways that we can use money as an effective tool to meet the needs of children and families. We will be having you back to talk about some exciting work that's happening on Jordan's Principle in terms of making sure that we're costing out Jordan's Principle in a way that really meets the growing needs of children, youth, and families across this country. Thank you all for joining us, and until next time, have a great day. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Spirit Bears Ask an Expert podcast. Be sure to tune in for more episodes coming up where we'll do this all again and find out what works for kids. And of course, you can find us on Twitter @Caring Society or visit our website, fncaringsociety.com, where you can get all kinds of information about this topic and our future episodes.